Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening our guest is Tom Horn, Reverend Tom Horn. I've known Tom for many, many years. He's written several books, and we've interviewed him before, on the gods who walk among us, spiritual warfare, and we still carry both of those books. We think they're an important insight into the message that we have, talking about the spiritual dimension which influences everything that's going on today. But this evening we're going to be talking about his latest book. It's a novel, but it really, of course, is based upon the fact of genetic engineering, this whole idea of trans-species engineering. It's called the Ehrman Gate, and of course it gets into some of the incredible things that are happening in science today as we try to engineer new types of human beings, and the military working with trying to engineer super soldiers, people who won't have to sleep or worry about eating, can fight for days, and we will create these new types of human beings, because they're much more effective as warfare agents. But what about the human compassion? What about the humanity? That isn't important in a soldier. A soldier's job is to kill and to destroy and to win the battles. Well, with that as a background, Tom Horn, thank you so very much for being with us again this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me on again, Dr. Stan.
Well, I'm going to let you pick up the story and how you got involved and really in getting into this whole idea of transgenetic engineering.
Well, you know, how I got involved was maybe 10, 12 years ago. I don't even remember now if it was a newspaper or a magazine article, but I read an article and it used this term transgenics, and I had never heard that term before. In fact, I was only vaguely familiar with cloning and some of the techniques that would be used in cloning. And so I wanted to find out more about this. And one of the things that stuck out to me in this first article that I had read was that year, fully one-fourth of all federal research grants were going towards funding transgenic research. And part of it, as you mentioned a moment ago, had to do with military applications. And as I started studying the idea about transgenics, I learned that when you're talking about transgenic science, you're talking about the blending of living organisms. You're talking about, taking a goat and creating a spider goat so that now you can have spider silk inside of a goat. And I could understand the military's interest in trying to develop those kind of things, but it was the ethical and moral issues behind it that I couldn't understand. And I just, for the life of me at the beginning, couldn't understand why I wasn't hearing anything more about this science. It seemed to me that it was something more than a novel science, especially given the fact that it was being so heavily funded by American tax dollars. And so I started digging into this, and I was amazed that I wasn't hearing anybody from the faith community, anybody from the church community, talking about what ethics might be raised through the idea that we were now going to breach species barriers which had been put in place by God. It was God himself who created and then said, let each of these various species recreate after their own kind. As a matter of fact, and we won't get into this tonight, but in the book of Leviticus there were even laws condemning sex with animals, which I think goes beyond that. I think it had something to do with the fact that there was to be this separation between these species, and that recreation and procreation was only to occur after the different species as it had been laid down by God. And now we were talking about science that was going to break those laws so that we could now start creating humans with animal DNA, creating animals with human DNA, and all of that.
Hold that thought, Tom. I'll be back in just a moment. Well, I guess this evening, Tom Horn, go ahead and pick this up. And we're talking then about this ability, this amazing ability science has. We can actually take genes from animals or from insects or from fish or and we can implant them into human beings and vice versa. We can plant human genes into animals to give them human intelligence. And we'll pick up the story there.
And we're doing that right now. I mean, we're creating sheep that have a human DNA. We're creating pigs that have human DNA. We've created mice that had 10% human brains last year. This year or next year, we're going to create mice that have 100% human brains. And they're actually developing the guidelines now that are to be used for the creation of these mice. And get this, one of the guidelines is that if the researchers begin to notice that these mice start becoming self-aware, then at that moment they have to be destroyed. One of the things that I argued with Dr. James Hughes on his Change Surfer Radio, who is a leading advocate of transhumanism. He's an ethics a professor at Trinity College in Hartford. And I said to him, yes, but if you create beings that start becoming self-aware and they start questioning their whereabouts, if you play God, then you have a responsibility to become God. You have to nurture these things that you create. What gives you the right to create something that then starts questioning its surroundings, and then you just simply destroy it? Those are the kind of Frankensteinian, mad, incomprehensible kind of ethical debates that we're going to be having in the very near future, or at least I hope we're having in the very near future. But now we're creating rabbits that have human DNA. We're creating monkeys and pigs and all these different things that are part human. And now, of course, we're also going to create humans that have part animal DNA in them as well, if transhumanists get to, get to have what they want in the very near future. And those are all being debated in our law schools and among our ethicists and also in some of our leading universities. And so, you know, how I got started with all of this is as soon as I started understanding that big question and was startled that I didn't hear any of the professors in our Bible colleges or any of our leading talking heads for the evangelical movement or the church, or even, for that matter, I wasn't even hearing anything coming out of the Vatican or anywhere else. I thought, well, you know, somebody needs to be talking about this. And so I wrote a couple of small editorials based on my limited knowledge at that time. 12, 13 years ago, you know, was just on the cusp of this technology coming out into the public. It's probably been being experimented on in, SAPOC laboratories.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Tom Horn. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Tom really became concerned about this whole issue of transgenetic engineering, a decade or more ago. And he thought, you know, why aren't we hearing about this from our church leaders? Why aren't we hearing about this from the people in the seminaries, from the Christian philosophers? I mean, what we're doing is scientists are playing God and violating God's injunction, reproduce each according to their species. And now we have the ability to begin to plant animal genes into humans and human genes into animals. So Tom then began writing about this. And from a moral point of view, I mean, where are we going? Where are we being led? And, well, of course, the biggest question at all is, how does God feel about this? Is he going to sit idly by, watch his creation be destroyed? Well, we heard the story. The same sort of things were happening before the days of Noah. And what was the response? God set out to destroy the whole world. Well, people say that's just a myth. You know, that's just a Bible story. But what happens if it's true? I believe it is true, and I believe there's a great deal of evidence that it is absolutely true. Is God about to intervene again? And, of course, remember Christ's words when he was asked about his return to earth. And what was his response? As it was in the days of Noah. So pick the story up there, Tom.
You're absolutely right, and that was some of the first feedback that I got. I mean, I was doing this research, and finally, I wrote a couple of editorials, and one of those editorials got picked up by, some fairly wide press. And lo and behold, out of the blue, Cal Thomas, the syndicated columnist for the LA Times, the co-host for CNN's Crossfire, he gets a hold of me and he says, Tom, and the thing about this was, I thought, man, if Cal Thomas hasn't heard anything about this, as plugged into the news as he is, it really did illustrate to me how at that point we were either on the cusp of this technology. It was a brand new technology, which I think is partly true, and it also had been covered up in terms of what the government was already doing in black budgets and SAPOC budgets, which we can talk about later if you want. But Cal contacted me and he said, Tom, he said, what you've written is evidence to me that we are fulfilling that prophecy that you just mentioned, Dr. Monteith, that as it was in the days of Noah. And Cal felt that, you know, with this happening, surely time is winding down and we've entered into a quickening of events now that foreshadow end times biblical prophecy. And as you know, it wasn't much long after that I was on your radio show, and we happened to be promoting the film by Cloud 10 Pictures called Deceived, starring Louis Gossett Jr. and Judd Nelson. And that movie illustrated the idea that, you know, people were trying to put themselves in connection with super intelligences that exist side by side with us in other dimensions, who they thought might be super intelligent aliens or something like that. And the movie indicates, of course, that it was more, you know, demonic presence. But the people that were putting themselves in contact were developing things like telekinesis and becoming altered from, you know, from being a normal human. And when you and I were promoting that film for Cloud 10 Pictures, you know, I knew you had been a medical doctor, and so I asked you if you believed that in the future we would actually produce these post-humans, transhumans, that would have things like telekinetic ability, and that we would do this through human enhancement, through blending humans with animals and things who have different modalities, they have different perception than we do. Would we do that through the sciences of transgenics and genetic engineering, biotechnology? And I remember you telling me that you had come back from a medical field convention in which they were talking about some of those very issues, and I think it had upset you very much. And I came out of that thinking, wow, you know, if this is happening and nobody in the faith community is really talking about this, then I think I will. So I started doing all of this research, anything I could get my hands on, talking to you know, people who were biotechnologists, anybody that was willing to talk to me, and finally we came out with this book that you're talking about now, The Ahriman Gate, which hopefully you've got by now.
I think we just got them in today.
Yeah, okay, so you've got those, and if people want to get a copy of that, they can get that directly from you. It's called The Ahriman Gate, and it's spelled Ahriman. It's the all-time best-selling book this year. For the publisher, it's got over 50 five-star reviews. We've had just hardly no negative feedback at all. We've had a ton of great feedback about it. I just got some more feedback today from people that are doing, who are actually in Iraq right now doing contract work for the federal government, military people, who today sent me an email talking about how it was being recommended among the ranks over there, and so. It's doing wonderful. They ought to get a hold of you and get a copy of that. Here's the thing, Dr. Monteith. Just since I spoke to you 2 days ago, Australia now passed legislation allowing the development of stem cell farms to be built where human clones are going to be mass-produced in assembly lines so that their genetic matter can be harvested for a medical research into some of the very things that we're talking about right now. It's absolutely astounding. And I know it's got to put your Hippocratic and other medical ethics oaths ringing in your ears when you realize that now we have law allowing human life to be created for the single explicit purpose of exploiting that life for experimentation and ultimately destruction. It's absolutely astonishing. And actually, it gets worse than that, because this bill allows stem cells to be extracted from the eggs of aborted babies, and the next step is that the DNA from aborted babies, from those eggs, is going to be extracted to produce clones, meaning that we're literally employing the science of Frankenstein here to murder and then reanimate over and over again God's creation as if it was nothing more than a mere commodity that we might plunder this human offspring in some selfish quest for immortality. The deal is, I want to live long too, but I'm not interested in living long if it means I have to take the life of some other human life in order to use that for myself. I mean, isn't that what the worshippers of Baal did? Burnt babies to Kronos in order to get blessings and extend their own life? It's astonishing. And it's only the first step towards this larger goal of using genetic matter, genetic byproducts, not just for the purposes of developing medicines for treatments of such things like Alzheimer and cancer and things like that, but transhumanists who are really starting to come out now. I mean, they're really starting to take the lead on these issues. They want to use this genetic matter of both humans and animals in order to change the nature of Homo sapiens through transhumanism. Dr. Monteith, isn't it astonishing how quickly things have changed in just this last decade, where you and I went just, 7, 8, 10 years ago, whatever it was, from just knowing, you know, hearing and knowing very little about the ramifications of this technology, to only one decade later, and now we're looking at human enhancement. This month, the John Templeton Foundation is providing $500,000 to Arizona State University for an entire lecture series to begin evaluating what they're calling the next chapter in human evolution, which they say is going to happen through large-scale genetic and neurological re-engineering of the human species. Earlier this year, only a couple of months before that, the Cleveland Law School received almost $1 million from the National Institutes of Health for developing guidelines, quote, for the use of human subjects in what will be the next frontier in medical technology, genetic enhancement of the human species, end quote. And it's Max Melhelm of the Case Law School, the professor there of bioethics, who's leading this whole team of bioethicists and physicists, the physicians and law professors, in a two-year project. It's only got about 18 months now left in it. And they're using human subjects to establish the guidelines that will be used for altering the human species through genetic enhancement. Anybody that thinks that's too astounding to be true can go right to Google, type in Case Law School in Cleveland, or Medical News Today, and type in the words that I'm saying, that the National Institutes of Health have provided almost $1 million, and they'll find out that what I'm saying is absolutely the truth. They're using human subjects right now to determine what guidelines need to be used for taking us into the next period in human evolution, and that is genetic enhancement and transhumanism through the use of these new sciences.
Well,
it's absolutely astonishing.
The problem we have is we have scientists who have no moral foundation, who do not believe in God, who believe that they can do whatever they want to without consequences. And because they do not believe that there is a law, an ultimate law in the universe, they see nothing to restrict them from creating new human beings or from destroying human beings or from destroying embryos. I mean, these are the sort of macabre things that happened, you know, in Hitler's Germany. I mean, there were scientists there who just wanted to try all sorts of horrible and macabre experiments. And what we're working on is not something that's going to improve humanity at all. We are going to try to change the very nature of humanity. We have man playing God. And, of course, this is where we're really in trouble because, you know, if God is just, he is not going to allow this to continue. And you come from a Christian perspective, and so do I. I think everybody out there in the listening audience should understand the implications of what's going on within science today, being funded, of course, with your tax money and the tax-exempt money of the great tax-exempt foundations. But at one time, many millennia ago, we lived in a society where there was also transgenic human beings. They were called Nephilim. And, of course, demonic spirits mated with women. And you remember what happened and how God responded. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, and you know, one of the things that you and I had talked about before, and we've talked about this on several occasions, and that is, what are these transhuman creations going to be like? What are they going to be like? Are they going to be like that woman in that movie Deceived that you and I was promoting, where they have, you know, like some form of telekinesis? In my book, The Ahriman Gate, which people can get directly from you, the bad guy in there, the main bad guy, you know, he starts developing these telekinetic mind-reading kind of powers, where he can start now seeing into other dimensions. But that happens to him as a result of being a transgenic mutation. And in this case, it's an experiment to see if Nephilim technology, you mentioned the Nephilim a moment ago, this is a case in which the military has an interest in trying to recreate these ancient beings, these ancient day creations. And in order to do that, they start making these bodies that they think will allow them to have, you know, perception outside of our three-dimensional reality. And what they don't realize is that these powerful demonic forces are using these bodies to incarnate themselves. But the deal is, besides fiction, the question is, how would transhumanism, as it's being envisioned by Nick Bostrom and people like that, who are some of the leading thinkers and who are fellows, who hold positions and are members of boards of our leading institutions, and who are strong advocates for creating these new transhumanist values, could it lead to things like telekinesis? Could it lead to things that are even more supernatural than that, in terms of their ability to even be able to perceive into these realms of the supernatural that have been sealed off in our minds? I never forget, Dr. Monteith, years ago I had the privilege of sitting under Dr. Bob Cornwall. Now, this for me was kind of like, you know, if somebody would have had the ability, like Paul had the opportunity to sit at the feet of Gamaliel. For me, sitting at the feet of Dr. Bob Cornwall was one of the great pleasures of my life. And I never forget him talking about the original Adam, and how that the original Adam in the Hebrew text, that there is this depiction of the original man as being able to see where God sees and speak into what God speaks into. And the whole implication from that being that the original man before the fall could see and speak into these other dimensions, including the so-called spirit or angelic realm. And it makes sense. We know that Adam and Eve could see God, and they walked with him openly, according to the Bible. They also could see Lucifer in the garden, and they spoke with him too. Then we see how that after the fall, man's ability to see into either of these was lost. It was closed off behind some kind of a dimensional veil, unless those beings now who exist there either choose to reveal themselves in some form, or we go looking for them.
And I think we actually, of course, the army has been really working on this, trying to tap into this other dimension. That's what this DVD we have with Lou Gossett Jr. is all about, is about this effort of an experimental military unit to tap into the other dimension. But we know that at Stanford, the Stanford Research Institute, and similar research institutes at our other major universities, there are people there who spend all of their time trying to learn how to tap into the other dimension, into the spiritual dimension, which is really very, very real. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Tom Horn. We were just simply talking about how, you know, it's the Stanford Research Institute and other major universities. There are scientists who spend their time trying to learn how to tap into this other spiritual dimension. How the military has been working to actually tap into this other dimension for many years. In fact, I was at a meeting recently where a military general, I believe he was a major general, I didn't actually see this, but the other people had seen it, was able to take a spoon, and this is a metallic spoon, and twist it around, and you know, and it just sort of like a pretzel. But he did this using what he had learned about through the military, of tapping into the other dimension. You've heard about some people bending spoons. I've never seen a spoon like that because, you know, I couldn't bend that spoon at all in any way. I mean, it wasn't simply bent. It was twisted like a pretzel. But this is a man, financed in this endeavor by your tax money. A major general in the United States Army tapping into the other spiritual dimension.
Well, and certainly, I mean, even during this most recent Afghanistan war, we read the stories that were released by reputable news sources where psychics working with the U.S. military were involved in the search for Osama bin Laden. The military certainly has had an interest in this for a long time. And now we know that according to the Bible and other sacred texts that these other dimensions exist. We also know, if you put faith in the Bible, which I do, that intelligent beings exist there. And even quantum physics is suggesting to us now this strong possibility of these parallel realities, multiple dimensions, that exist just beyond the casual grasp of our three-dimensional of us three-dimensional humans, or at least humans as we know them today. And the Bible is actually full of references to these beings that exist around us. They're, in the Hebrew, the word is Elohim, which can refer to everything from Yahweh to the Son of God to angels to demons. Even the spirits of dead humans are universally referred to throughout the Bible as being there. Now, after the fall of man, the sons of Adam couldn't any longer casually look there. And I think that's the interest that the military has. Something in the mind was closed. The gateway was shut off. But it doesn't mean that those beings aren't still there and that under some circumstances they can interact with our three-dimensional reality. For instance, you remember Peter, James, and John. They followed Jesus to the Mountain of Transfiguration, and Moses and Elijah materialized there. There's another example in the Bible, a spookier example in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel 28, when Saul goes to the witch of Endor, and he has her make contact with the spirit of Samuel. You've heard some people say that it wasn't really the spirit of Samuel, but that it was a pretending spirit or a so-called familiar spirit. But in this case, it doesn't matter if it was really the spirit of Samuel or a deceiving spirit. It doesn't change two things. One, that the Bible warns against communicating with these other dimensionals, whether you see them as ghosts or lying spirits or whatever. And secondly, that narrative makes the case that under either point of view, intrusion into our plane of existence by other dimensional beings is possible, especially where we invite them or where we seek them out. And that takes me back, Dr. Monteith, to what scientists and biotechnologists and other researchers and what Dr. Cornwall believed, that such things as research into the mind or into the brain could potentially lead into opening a portal. You've read a rash of stories lately where, on the one hand, you have UFO researchers who are using psychedelic drugs to get in contact with extraterrestrial entities. Now, have those men just hallucinated, or have they opened a part of the mind, sealed off by God after the fall, something that somehow partially allows them to see into the spirit or other dimensional world? I think it's pretty good theology because the book of Revelation 21:8 condemns sorcery using the word pharmakeia, or those who use drugs and potions and spells and enchantments in order to interact with the spirit world. And that is a biblical story that tells us that there are doorways of the mind that can be opened out of rebellion against God. You've also seen where experiments with the atmosphere now and acoustics have created ghost-like materializations in research laboratories. And now, according to a new study that came out about a month ago, when a specific region of the brain called the left TPJ is stimulated, it can create the illusion of a shadow person. Did you read about that?
No, I really haven't.
Well, it's a finding that actually emerged by accident. A neurologist by the name of Olaf Blanke of the Brain Mind Institute in Switzerland and his colleagues, they were attempting to identify the source of epileptic seizures in a 23-year-old woman. And they started applying this mild electrical current through surgically implanted electrodes to various regions of her brain.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Tom Horn, and we're simply discussing the fact is that there really are things out there that defy scientific explanation. Because, of course, scientists try to think they do not believe in the supernatural. But if you believe in the Bible, you also believe in the supernatural, and you believe that certainly that time and time again we hear stories about, you know, how either Jesus or his disciples were dealing with people who were possessed. They were possessed by devils, and of course they were told in the scriptures to avoid fortune tellers or people who are into witchcraft, because of course they're in the process of contacting these beings from another dimension. We're told to avoid divining. Of course, diviners, you can divine the water witches are diviners. And I will tell you that this actually works, but you don't want to be fooling around with that, because you're tapping into the supernatural dimension, and of course you'd never know where that's going to lead. So pick up the story there, Tom.
Well, and I was telling you about this brand new study that came out, where... When the specific regions of the brain, and there's actually the long term for it, but I'm not a doctor like you, I can't say the long term, so I use the abbreviation TPJ. It's a part of the brain, and when it's stimulated, it can create this illusion that you are being accompanied by a shadow person. Now, that's a finding that was reported, it was fairly well reported in good media about maybe 6-8 weeks ago, when this neurologist, Olaf Blanke, was leading a team of people at the Brain Mind Institute in Switzerland, who were attempting to identify the source of epileptic seizures in this woman. And they were applying this mild electrical current through these surgically implanted electrodes to various parts of her brain. And when they reached the left TPJ, suddenly she reported feeling the presence of a mystery person behind her, what she described as a motionless, speechless shadow that imitated her body posture and actions. The interesting thing, though, is this woman said he lay beneath her when she lay down, and he sat behind her when she sat down, and in another time he didn't just mimic her, she said he actually attempted to take a test card away from her when she tried to participate in a language exercise. Now, these scientists are viewing this phenomenon within their own disciplines, of course, as possibly explaining a basis for delusions or schizophrenia. And in that case, they might be on the right track. But I can't tell you, Dr. Monteith, how that report immediately made me think of the old Egyptian ancient religious teachings of
Hold that thought, Tom. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and here's Tom is talking about experiments, certainly some of them done over in Europe, where they can stimulate certain parts of the brain, and these people will get the feeling of an ethereal being almost like a demonic spirit or an invisible spirit experiment, invisible being in the world with them. And pick up the rest of your thought there, Tom.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were calling it a shadow person, something that pretty much followed this person around and mimicked each of their movements most of the time, but not in all cases. And the thing for me was how much, when I read that story, I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe this is nothing more than science. Maybe this is a trick of the brain. But it sounded so much to me like my old studies into Egyptian religion and the teachings about the Ka, the K-A, the Ka, which for Christians might be something roughly equivalent to the soul, except in religious teaching this was more of a duplicate self that followed you throughout your life and then became the eternal you after judgment. But the thing I wanted to insert here, Dr. Monteith, was that, you know, as you mentioned when we came onto the show tonight, I was a pastor for more than 25 years. I was also a member of a team of exorcists for about 24 months. And I got to tell you, I saw things during that period of time that can't be described as delusions of a schizophrenic personality. In fact, there's one famous case now that was recorded in the book Spiritual Warfare, The Invisible Invasion, in which there was more than 40 of us on site when a young demon-possessed boy, the son of an Assemblies of God pastor, was brought in. And this team didn't approach exorcism in the way that many people do today, in which they just, you know, they'll perform these rites over anybody and everybody. This team was, I mean, there were medical doctors, there were psychologists. They very much evaluated every person to make sure that it wasn't just a problem with, you know, biochemistry, I mean, with the chemical reactions of the brain or some other phenomenon, or just, or the fact that they just simply weren't all there mentally. They put them through a process that determined whether they believed they were actually possessed by the time they were brought to this team. And but that young guy, I'll never forget him, very skinny, very small young man, and he was literally picking people up and throwing them across the room. I never seen anything like it in my whole life. And there was one point at which he ran and he leaped through this room. He took off running and towards me, and he leaped through the room. And I'm not kidding you when I tell you that he smacked into something invisible, just like there was some kind of an invisible wall. He hit that thing face first, fell flat down on the ground, and at that moment, everybody that was in that room, Dr. Monteith, fell down. All 40 of those people fell down on their face and started worshiping Jesus Christ, because at that moment, it was the first time they had been eyewitnesses to a phenomenon outside of their understanding of physics, and yet they knew that for some reason, one way or the other, that this spiritual force was subject to the name of Christ, and they had never seen that before. I'd never seen it before. And it changed me, and it changed the people that were in that room. So in a way, now I said that to say this, that's the reason why when I read that UFO researchers are claiming that mind-altering drugs are opening gateways to the spirit world, something, by the way, that American Indian tribes also claim for many thousands of years, hundreds of years, it's the reason why I don't discount that as necessarily being hallucinations. Or when researchers are tinkering with the atmosphere, or when portions of the brain are being tampered with and it creates these ghosts and shadow people. It's a reason that I'm open to the idea that we might be reaching back into a distant past when original Adam was something different than we are now. And after the fall, God in His mercy closed off these areas in the same way that a loving father or mother might put up some kind of a barrier in a doorway to keep a 2-year-old toddler from walking into a room where there are things that can hurt that child. The child simply is not capable of perceiving the dangers that are there, but the parent is. And out of care and out of love, the parent will block that doorway. And it seems to me now that you're correct, that the military and other entities have an interest in kicking down that blockage. They want to break down the blockage. And the question is, how might changing us as a species now reopen doors or gateways of the mind, which, frankly, we know so little about, including why there are parts of it that seem to be closed off and beyond our understanding? Will these regions of the mind, brain, be reopened through altering us, through blending us as a species? Well, I got to tell you, I've talked directly with the leading members of the Transhumanist Society, and I can tell you that some of them, that's exactly what they're hoping for. There was the Finnish Transhumanist Association published a study recently that was peer-reviewed within their own circle, in which they said that super intelligence can be reached through the blending of these different species, human and animal. And the startling thing about the report was they said this would be a creation that would be capable of doing both great good or great harm, depending on its own individual goals. And as soon as I read the Finnish Transhumanist Society's report on that, I thought, well, you know, this sounds to me like we're developing a method that could be, potentially, this is just a theory, but could be the method through which an antichrist would be incarnated, a super intelligence that would be capable of leading the world astray. Another thing is that this is, sounds to me like a method for creating the end time army that's described in the book of Revelation, that is so heartless, so vicious towards Christians and those that are slain because they are followers of Christ. And of course, if you've read my book, The Ahriman Gate, which people can get from you, those are the kind of super transgenic soldiers that we created when we were doing research into transgenics for that book. because we knew that we planned to infer a return of the biblical Nephilim as a result of man tinkering with the human genetic code, and that those would be the end-time army prophesied by Isaiah the prophet to return at the end of time. And one of the things, talking about the mind, that we also found, Dr. Monteith, when we were doing research into the Nephilim, was that in addition to gigantism, some of the ancient descriptions of the Nephilim include things like psychic abilities and mind control. And so when you read what Nick Bostrom at his website, who's a leading transhumanist advocate, he's a professor of philosophy at Oxford University, when you read what he wrote in his thesis on transhumanist values about the current human sensory modalities not being the only ones, and that through merging man with animal we could open up these other modalities, you kind of understand maybe what was going on in Genesis 6, where the B'nai Elohim saw the daughters of Adam, that they were fit extensions, a molecular pathway through which they could extend themselves from their dimension into our three-dimensional reality. So, here's the thing. Today, molecular biologists, they classify the functions of genes within their native species. But molecular biologists are not sure, in most cases, how a gene's coding is going to react from one species to another. It's very likely that unpredictable things will happen, and we're seeing that already, aren't we, in genetically modified crops.
Yes, we are. Oh, we've got Herman hanging on the line patiently from Carmel. Let's get Herman's call. I'll ask other people not to call, but as long as Herman's been waiting for so long. Herman, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. Well, as I was listening to you talk about the different dimensions, it occurred that, you know, radio is a interesting metaphor. People that are listening on the radio right now are getting a clear signal, and yet you can turn the dial ever so slightly and get a completely different program coming in on a different frequency. And, you know, that might be a metaphor for different dimensions for people that say, well, how could there possibly be something else right close by or around me, and yet I'm not able to perceive it? Any comments?
It's an excellent point. In fact, have you ever thought that through both the manipulation of ourselves, through genetic tinkering, and also our environment. Do you remember this story recently about DARPA hiring HARP to create a radiation belt remediation system, which they envisioned as a way of protecting low Earth orbiting satellites from damage caused by either solar storms or high-altitude nuclear detonations? You remember that story?
I hadn't heard that, no.
Well, it was something that they thought might work by using extremely high-intensity, very low-frequency radio waves to flush particles from radiation belts and then dump it back into the upper atmosphere. And some of the ham radio operators and all the rest of them began saying, well, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? And some scientists also warned that it might cause unprecedented changes to the atmosphere, and so DARPA and HARP said that they were kind of backing off of that. But think about that. You know, through genetically changing ourselves, and then also through changing our environment in those ways, we could actually bring ourselves into contact with forces that are completely incapable of dealing with. Because, first of all, think about this. Tinkering with frequencies and atmosphere, and I'm only using this because you happen to mention radio waves. Who is it that the Bible and other holy books describe as the God of the air? The God
like
of the
Lucifer,
atmosphere.
Yeah, Satan.
That's right, Beelzebub, the Lord of those that flit in the atmosphere, the prince of the powers of the air, Satan. Or as in the case of my book, Ahriman, the God of Ahriman Abad, the Hebrew equivalent of cosmos. And then we're tinkering with things like sound, and we're weaponizing acoustics. Do you remember Vic Tandy's experiments with infrasound frequency below the range of human hearing? And it actually caused what appeared to be alien grays and ghosts to come out of the darkness after him. And he was an unbeliever. and a scientist, and he wrote in his thesis, Ghosts in the Machine, which was published in the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research about that phenomenon. And he did additional research into that. And he was a scientist and a skeptic that believed all of this was just in his head, a trick of frequencies and eyeball resonation. But my thought about it at the time was maybe he just didn't understand the door that he was opening.
Amen
to that. Have you heard anything about Iraq containing a location for an ancient stargate, and that could be one of the reasons that we went in there, and that there might be things going on
Yes, I've heard about that, and you have to ask yourself, first of all, I think it's painfully obvious to Americans now that we never had good intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction. If we went there to take control of oil, then you have to ask yourself why we're getting less of it now than ever before. Other people say that we went there to spread democracy, but I've always said I don't believe that you do that with the tip of a cannon barrel. And I think Dr. Monteith has a brand new book out now about the controllers of the world that people ought to get and buy. What's the name of that book, Dr. Monteith?
Brotherhood of Darkness.
Yeah.
But it's been around for quite a while, but it's still a pretty good book, even if I do say so.
Well, but I mean, it might help people understand a little more about the fact that, the difference between democracy and a republic. But now you notice how the infrastructure over in Iraq has also been left in disrepair. And we said when we went in there, that we were going to use their oil to keep their infrastructure taken care of. The deal is, it's the biggest mess on the face of the planet. So if none of the reasons that we first said we were going in there were true, then why did we go there? Now, it is possible that we went there as strategic placement in the Middle East because one of our war colleges has anticipated that there is going to be a growing problem with Russia, a new Asia, alliance, with, and also Russia and the Chinese aligning themselves. And so maybe we decided that one of our teachers in our war colleges, that we need to have a strategic placement in the Middle East in order to take care of that situation. That could be true. But maybe we also went there to take control of something that was found. And as esoteric as that sounds, remember that Saddam Hussein considered himself to be the resurrected Nebuchadnezzar. He spent a $500 million rebuilding Babylon and doing archaeological digs and recovery of artifacts, some of which the general public has never seen yet or knows nothing about. Also keep in mind that this rebuilding of Babylon is very prophetic to Christians who see the reconstruction of Babylon as being prophetic, and they tie that to Isaiah's chapter 13 prophecy of an end times destruction of Babylon. And some people wonder now if this is why the United States is building this giant embassy, the biggest one in the world. I mean, it's 10 times bigger than any of other embassies. And if they're doing that because the administration, which many people believe sees itself as kind of the agentur of prophecy anyway, that they're trying to resurrect Babylon as some great center, or that at least when they went there, that's what they were thinking, from which the known world would then be manipulated or attracted. Maybe that's true.
Let me just intervene here before we get too far along. We're almost to the end of the hour, and we could go on for several hours. But, in President Bush's second inaugural address, and you can get that at whitehouse.gov, this is a speech he gave on the 20th of January, 2005, when he became the president. This was the inaugural speech. And next to the last paragraph there, he said, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, when our soldiers died row on row in pursuit of a union based upon liberty, when our Americans marched in righteous indignation between a banner of freedom now, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. Now, you have to understand, of course, that esoteric writing, what you do is you put something at the beginning, at the end of the sentence, and then you throw a lot of things in the middle to fool the average common people. What President Bush really said was, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. You can read it there in the in his speech. What is this ancient hope that, and of course you talk about ancient Babylon, and is there another agenda behind everything going on today? And I would like to suggest there is. For when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled, and everybody should, I think, should be asking what that is. We're just about out of time. Herman, thank you so very much for calling.
Thank you. Fascinating program.
Okay, fine. And, of course, our guest this evening has been Tom Horn. Tom, how about your website? Let's get that out.
Okay, and by the way, thank you, Herman, for your excellent questions. Yes, our website, www.RaidersNewsUpdate.com, just like the football team, RAIDERS. News Update, RaidersNewsUpdate.com.
Go there. There's all sorts of fascinating material. And, of course, the Radio Liberty newsletters are going to be posted there very soon. Well, Tom, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, what can I say? You know, the thing is, both the military, also the government, they're funding things that are going to take us into areas where we've never gone before. Animals can see things and do things. And you was talking about the supernatural. Earlier, we're going to blend ourselves with animals. Did you ever think that our understanding of quantum physics, including light and dark matter, also our understanding of the Bible, is going to be more fully appreciated concerning these references from the Bible to beings of light and beings of darkness? That we have reason to believe that some animals, Dr. Monteith, may be able to see. Maybe that's why DARPA is interested in this. The Bible even provides verification of that in the story of Balaam's donkey, where the donkey can see the angel with its sword drawn and Balaam cannot. Maybe this is why we have budgets, SAPOC budgets right now, that are funding government research laboratories into transgenic research, some of which has been admitted by DARPA, for the creation of super soldiers, as you started this show by talking about, who can see into, potentially interact with, dimensions that have been closed off since God wiped out the Nephilim in the Great Flood.
Well, I think we're living in the most exciting times in history. I think most people have no idea what's going on, but it's because they're not coming from a religious perspective. And, of course, knowing God's Word and studying God's Word, you'll find all sorts of answers to these imponderable questions that are haunting people today. And at Stanford Research Institute, at similar institutes at other major universities, and within the military, they're doing all sorts of experiments to tap into the other dimension. And let me advise you, ladies and gentlemen, there's great power there. There's great knowledge there. But tapping into the other dimension, of course, you put yourself at risk for eternal damnation. Do not do it. No matter what the attraction might be. Why, of course, there is no way back. I do know people have been there and they've given their life to Jesus and, of course, been able to come out. But this is not imaginary. It's really very real. Tom Horn, it's been always a pleasure having you, and I hope that we'll get a chance to talk again sometime real soon. And feel free to just pick up my newsletters off the Internet and post them. We'd be glad to have them there.
Well, we're having that built right now, and very soon we've got about 16 leading thinkers such as yourself who will, and we're very happy about it, grace the front page of the Raiders News Network.
God bless, and thanks so very much, Tom.
You too.
And thanks for those books. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we will be carrying, we have the books right now, the Ahriman Gate, and of course it's written as fiction, but it's really based upon the fact, and the scientists, the scientific work that's going on there, and the scientific papers, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are people who are trying to create a transgenic human beings. Animals with human attributes and genes in them, and human beings with animal capabilities. The animal genes transplanted into human beings, half animal, half human. Sounds incredible. People say these things couldn't happen. Why would anybody do anything like that? It's because we're dealing with people who have an entirely different worldview, who have no human compassion, people who serve a different God. And you say, well, I don't believe there could be people like that. And let me ask you, why do you think that we are over in the Middle East today? It's said that up to 600,000 Iraqis may have died as a result of our intervention there. And what's the solution? We're going to continue exactly what we've been doing in the past. And if you think that we're going to pull out of Iraq here at any time in the foreseeable future, why, you're incredibly naive and you really don't understand the true nature of the evil that we are engaged and combating today. For we're truly involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. The book, The Aramond Gates, available. Of course, you should read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You should read Malachi Martin's book, Hostage to the Devil, and you can get that along with his four-tape set of my interviews with Malachi and Malachi Martin special. Then, of course, we hope you'll want to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, their DVDs or videos, three-hour, four-hour, ten-hour version. The DVD, the award-winning DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And then, of course, Chris Pinto's other excellent videos and DVDs that we do carry. And you'll certainly want to think very much about getting those as well. We hope that, of course, you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. We carry a wonderful book called The Hope of the Wicked, written by Ted Flynn. We have the book, it's entitled Diary of a Devil Hunter. Diary of a Devil Hunter. We have four tape sets on the supernatural. We have a four tape set on Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, and of course he was really the inspiration for so much of what's going on today. We have the book Blood on the Altar. We have another book written by Johanna Michelson entitled The Beautiful Side of Evil. Johanna was actually a medium, and she had those supernatural powers that she could see into the other dimension. Of course, until she renounced them, and of course became a Christian, and she lost that ability. But of course, she really didn't lose anything. Basically, she gained the ability to have a personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, let me suggest Chris Pinto's DVDs, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2. All of these will help you better to understand what indeed is going on in the world today. These spiritual forces, not imaginary, really very real. You know, you can get all of the items we've talked about, starting with the Aramond Gate, by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Many people find it difficult to believe that what you saw in 911 was staged, that anybody would be so evil as to allow 3,000 Americans to perish and knowing exactly what was going to happen. Well, we've got five DVDs. We call it the 911 special. You can get all five of them if you'd like to at a very special rate. That includes 911 Mysteries, 911 Press for the Truth, Terror Storm by Alex Jones, In Plain Sight by Davon Kleiss, and of course one most people have never heard of, but we think is very good because it's put out from a Christian perspective, entitled The Day That Changed America Forever, 911. Remember our number, it's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guest. And this hour, we're going to have Dr. Miriam Grossman, who's going to be talking to us about her book called Unprotected. And the book was originally subtitled, A Campus Psychiatrist Reveals How Political Correctness in Her Profession Endangers Every Student. Let me repeat that. A Campus Psychiatrist Reveals How Political Correctness in Her Profession Endangers Every Student. You mean they're doing things on our college campuses that are endangering our students? And, of course, as you read the book, you realize, of course, that's true. In fact, Dr. Grossman, as a psychiatrist who works at a prestigious university, and of course he originally wrote this book as anonymous. It was titled Anonymous MD, and of course eventually she decided to come forward and reveal how she felt, because her feelings are so opposite from those of so many other psychiatrists and psychologists, from many people in our universities who have a different agenda, who want to change the worldview of our young people. And, of course, by so doing, they've destroyed their lives, and destroyed them not only physically but emotionally as well. Dr. Grossman, thank you so very much for being with us. Why don't you tell our listeners how it was that you now, of course, instead of having the book written by Anonymous, now have your own name attached to it.
Yes. Well, first of all, good evening, and thanks for having me. Before getting into it, I would just like to say that the views that I express are not the views of the University of California at Los Angeles. And in addition, I would like to mention just for a moment that the people working in our student health and counseling services all over the country are extremely hardworking and devoted professionals, and lives are being saved by them each day. I just feel it's important to start off on that note.
All right, fine. But, of course, unfortunately, the attitude of so many people today is this total permissiveness. As you point out, you know, we tell the children, oh, my goodness, you know, you don't want to be smoked, that's bad for your health, and you want to drink, that's bad for your health, but you go out and have sex, just have safer sex, because there's no such thing as safe sex. Just have safer sex, and if you get human papillomavirus, well, a lot of people, most people have it, don't even worry about it. I mean, just pick up these stories, because you point out the inconsistency, almost the madness of what's going on today.
Yes, madness is an excellent word. It is a madness, and it's that madness and frustration and anger that led me to sitting down and writing down some of these stories, because I felt that parents and really everyone needs to know that this sort of thing is happening. I do make the case in the book that our universities and health organizations endanger young people, especially young women, by promoting the notion of safe or safer sex. That's one of a few notions that are being promoted, but that's the first one that I deal with in the book. And I say that by failing to provide medically accurate information about sexual behavior and hooking up and friends with benefits, that young people are paying a tremendous price.
And usually it's much more so the girls than the boys many times, although I'm sure it can both ways. In fact, I'd never heard of the hormone oxytocin that you talk about. That shows how far I am out of things. I've been retired now for about 12 years, but you know, there's so much we understand now that we didn't understand before, and there really is, of course, a bonding that takes place with sexual intimacy. And, of course, these young girls go from, you know, from one affair to another affair. It's the most normal thing in the world, or is it? Is
yes, it has.
Hold it. Dr. Grossman, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Are we on the air now?
We're on the air right now. You'll have to just, you'll hear the music from time to time, and I'll just guide you right, but I want you to go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yes, the hooking up and the anything goes mentality. So here are some numbers, if you're ready. This is quite shocking. We know now that up to 80% of students on our campuses have participated in what is called a hookup, being defined as a sexual encounter between two people who are either strangers or know each other very superficially, and more importantly, have no plans whatsoever to ever even talk again. So that is the definition of a hookup, and the research does show that 80% of students have participated in such a situation, and the average number by graduation from college is nearly 11 hookup partners. That's the average. So this is the campus norm now. This is what how people are expected to behave, and young women feel pressure to fit in, and this is the way for them to feel accepted if they will participate in this kind of behavior. Now, what I'm speaking about in the book, it's important to emphasize that I am not talking about morals, and I'm not talking about what's right and wrong in the eyes of God and so on. I am writing this book as a physician. I wrote the book as a physician. The research was done in a medical library, and that's how I got to the information about oxytocin that you mentioned. And I, too, was not familiar with this very interesting hormone. It's a hormone that's released during sexual behavior, sexual activity, and it's the same hormone that's released in a mother when she nurses her baby. So it's a hormone that we know it brings feelings of attachment and trust. This is the hormone that's being released during the hookups that are going on our campuses, and I'm here to tell everyone that young people are suffering from the chaos this plays on their emotions without even getting into the STD issue, but just the biological effect that it has on the emotions of young women, and they are coming in brokenhearted, not understanding why they can't just go from one person to the next.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. Miriam Grossman, who's a psychiatrist, and she is dealing with these young people in the college campus. You know, many of them young women who are just devastated because of their sexual encounters, because they've had this bonding experience and associated with a hormone I'd never heard of, but of course she goes into some detail on something called oxytocin, which is released during sexual intimacy, and suddenly this girl is bonded to a fellow, and he doesn't want to see her again. And this has a profound emotional impact on her. And then, of course, Dr. Grossman brings out in her book so well the devastating incidence of sexually transmitted diseases among our college students. So, but you pick up the story because you tell it so well, because you have to deal with these tragic young people whose very lives are just shaken to their core.
Yes, thank you. Well, there is something that you may remember from your years in medical school, or, you know, in training. I don't know if you remember doing any OBGYN, but there is a piece of information that our young women need to know and their parents need to know, which is not getting out there, and it's really vital that we know that. The cervix of a young woman is different than a cervix of an older person, and that is because there's an area of cells which are more vulnerable to infection. It's right at the opening of the uterus, and as a young woman gets a bit older, this area gets smaller and smaller. So it's sort of, you could think of it like a target with a bullseye. And when the young woman is 14, 15, 16, it's large. And then as she gets older, with every year that she gets a little bit older, it shrinks down. So these bacteria and viruses that are being introduced in these casual relationships, the younger you are, the larger the risk of getting one of these diseases. And one of the things that I'm writing about in the book is I simply can't understand why this is not common knowledge, because right there you have a reason to delay, to encourage young women to delay sexual behavior. It doesn't have to do with religion or morality. It has to do with how her body is designed.
Because I can remember when I went to medical school, remember I graduated from medical school over 50 years ago, but you know, at that time, you know, you did not see the promiscuity. Oh, certainly may have been a little of it, but nothing like there is today. I mean, most people believed you should not have sex before marriage. That's passé today. In fact, they're even, as I read your book, it's almost as if, you know, the websites, the instructions that girls, young girls are getting, it's just go ahead and do it. You know, everybody's doing it. You have a good time. And of course, but I went to school before Alfred Kinsey's work came out, his fraudulent research, and of course we had a much different society. We had 5 sexually transmitted diseases. I was reading your book. You said there are 25 sexually transmitted diseases. My goodness, how the world has changed.
Well, yes, everything you're saying is correct. It's a very big problem, but the question that I'm focused on is why are the universities and the medical organizations not treating this public health catastrophe like we treated smoking, you know, binge drinking, fast foods, and so on. The list seems endless. Why do we go to such lengths to educate people about every other sort of health hazard? But in this area, our standards are so low, and we just expect people, we hope people will limit their partners and use condoms. It just doesn't make sense to me. Why don't we have higher expectations, or why don't we have the same expectations of self-discipline, self-control that we have in other areas of health?
But of course, you make the point in your book that there seem to be people out there who have a different agenda. They have a different worldview. And there are many of the health professionals who you would think would be, you know, trying to help the children are encouraging this sort of irresponsible, in my opinion, irresponsible behavior that is going to have such disastrous consequences on them.
Well, it is astonishing. This is not, what I'm going to describe now is not taking place on my campus at UCLA. But it's taking place on other campuses. I did quite a bit of research on the Internet. The most alarming site that I found was a site belonging to the health services at Columbia University. It's a site called goaskalice.com. And it has plenty of excellent health information on there. But if you go into the portion of the site that has to do with sexuality, I think that parents are going to be... I don't even know how to say what their reaction is going to be. I mean, I'm still shocked when I go on, and I've been on that site dozens of times.
And you're a physician, and so you certainly would be used to all of these things.
Well, actually, no, because some of these things have nothing to do with health.
I mean,
some of these behaviors, threesomes, foursomes, swinging, I mean,
bestiality.
Things that I get, you know what, I it's hard for me to even talk about this with you on the phone because it is so unacceptably fringe and risky, and I don't get how the same people who are concerned about disease can also be telling students how to arrange a threesome. I don't understand how that happened.
But of course, it also gets into masochism and sadism, and I was amazed what you wrote. They say there's really nothing wrong with it unless it has some psychological detrimental effect.
Well, that's right. The American Psychiatric and Psychological Associations in the 90s, I believe the early 90s, decided that sexual sadism and sexual masochism are not disorders. They used to be categorized as disorders, but they no longer are unless they cause the person distress or impairment in functioning. So these behaviors are not listed as disorders, and in fact they are, I would say, promoted by some universities. There's universities that have student clubs devoted to sexual sadism and masochism. I know that this is shocking. It's hard for me to go into this material, but I think parents have to know about it.
I think they do, too, and I think your book does a wonderful job of bringing out the information. When you send your child off to university, you expect they're going to get an education. Well, they are going to get an education, but not necessarily the sort of education you want to put out a lot of money for them to get.
Well, I would say so. It is alarming and it is disturbing, and that's why I sat down and told these stories. Each chapter deals, as you know, with a different topic. The promiscuity and sexually transmitted diseases are only two of the different subjects that I go into.
Well, one of the points you make is that the children with who have a belief of faith, a religious faith, these children really seem to do much better in this environment than the other children. Would you like to elaborate a little on that?
Sure. Well, I found research that indicated that the kids who themselves are living within a framework of strong beliefs, belief in God, prayer, religious coping meaning belonging to a religious community, worshiping with others, confession, turning to God for comfort and for strength. These are all, well, not only in students, but really in the population that uses those techniques to cope with stress, these people do better both emotionally and physically. And there's a mountain of evidence showing that everything from blood pressure to dealing with illness and loss, trauma, death of a child, God forbid, all these things are easier to cope with for people who have a strong faith to rely on.
Yeah, but of course, as a psychiatrist, aren't you sort of at a disadvantage even discussing that? Because most psychiatrists, at least those that I've known through the years, do not believe that they believe faith is a very superficial thing, but they sort of scoff at it. It's, you know, as if, well, it's sort of a make-believe idea.
Yes. Absolutely. There's the numbers of atheists among psychologists is five times the amount in the general population. So you're really much more likely to find somebody who's either an atheist or someone who has moved away, distanced themselves from the faith of their upbringing. And if they do have some religious or spiritual life, it's more likely to be in some alternate spiritual path and not in a mainstream religion. That is true about my colleagues.
Well, anyway, I'm glad that you're there, and I'm glad that you're utilizing your talent and your ability to help these young people and to point out, you know, that they're pretty leaving themselves open not only for all sorts of physical ailments but for psychological ailments. You know, certainly, you know, if you put off having sexual intimacy until you're ready to be married, why, you just don't have to worry ordinarily about these sexually transmitted diseases. Of course, you might very well end up marrying somebody. You would hope that they had been faithful as well and not been promiscuous. But that's the only way you're really going to avoid this. There's no such thing as safe sex. They may call it safer sex, but when we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease today, I would say that is either one of the greatest public health failures of all time, or maybe, just maybe, there's another agenda. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Miriam Grossman to talk about her book, fascinating book, Unprotected. And that's really what it's all about. Our young people are being sent out into life, and they're not protected because they do not have a grounding in what's right and what's wrong, what's going to be better for them physically and emotionally. Well, Dr. Grossman, one of the statements you make is that you talk about AIDS, and you make the statement that AIDS isn't as much of a threat to the average American as it's made out to be, and what do you mean by that?
Well, I'd rather reword that. I would say that that we need to be aware that HIV is a risk that's related to certain behaviors. It's not related to necessarily sexual orientation, race, socioeconomic class. It has to do with behaviors. There are high-risk behaviors, and those are sharing, doing intravenous drugs and sharing needles, having anal intercourse, or having a sexual partner that does one of those two things. And that's the bottom line. It doesn't matter male, female, heterosexual, gay, straight. If someone is engaging in those behaviors, and there are plenty of young heterosexual women who are having anal intercourse because they want to prevent pregnancy, and many women consider themselves to be virgins if they have only had anal intercourse. So I am trying to discuss this very, very difficult, sensitive, politically incorrect subject because I've had patients sit in front of me, and I have a chapter describing a young woman who has, as they say, freaked out because she's so worried that she may have HIV, and yet she's had no risk behaviors whatsoever, but she's been misled to think that having vaginal sex that is unprotected is a high-risk activity, which it is not. And then I talk in another chapter about a young man who is having anonymous, unprotected anal intercourse, and I write how he doesn't have enough concern about his high-risk behavior and how my hands were tied in trying to help him because there really wasn't too much I could do.
In other words, if you were to tell him what he was doing was wrong, why, you'd be criticized?
Well, no, that's not what I meant. And it's not, I don't want to use the word wrong either. I'm somewhat obsessive about this. It's not wrong. It's a high risk, low risk, healthy, not healthy, that type of thing. I hope you understand that. I'm not getting into using
judgmental terms.
That's correct.
All right, fine.
So what I meant with the patient who I called Brian is that he admitted to me that he was having anonymous encounters, and he had never been tested, and he had no plans to be tested, and I couldn't convince him to be tested. And so, unlike other situations, for example, I compare it to, well, there's many different situations where I can step in if I think that a patient is at risk for, you know, their health is at risk, or they're endangering another person, or there's a, you know, child abuse possibility. I have been given certain rights. I can pick up the phone, and I can call, you know, social workers, or I can call an 800 number. I can arrange for someone to be hospitalized against their will if I think that they're suicidal, and so on and so on. But with this young man, I wanted so much to be able to intervene and have him tested and, if necessary, start treatment because, as you know...
Hold that stuff. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. Miriam Grossman. We're talking about certainly some of the frustrations and her job as a psychiatrist with a young man who's had a number of sexual contacts, homosexual contacts, and certainly he didn't want to be tested. He was not going to change his lifestyle. These were multiple people he was having these contacts with. And so Dr. Grossman, wanting to intervene, wanting him to be tested, if he was HIV positive, there might be a very good chance that he would be, you know, to get him into treatment, and yet he absolutely refused. So what happened, Dr. Grossman?
Well, here's the thing, is that this was a young man, maybe 20, 22 years old, who was really too young to remember. Well, I mean, he was born after AIDS, you know, the early years of AIDS when everyone was so alarmed about it, and so he had a different kind of an attitude. Like a lot of young people do these days, that it's more like a chronic disease, and, you know, which it has become that way, but for some people. But the point was that I wanted to convince him, and he was too anxious to do it and didn't want to think about it. I wanted to convince him to go and get tested, and if it did turn out positive, to start treatment, because the treatment, the earlier the better. It's just like with any other condition. You know, you diagnose it, you get it treated earlier, you're going to live longer. And I could not either get him to go for testing, and I had no legal ability to make sure that would happen. I couldn't do anything except urge him to be more safe, to limit his contacts, and to use quote unquote protection, and to go for testing. But I don't know if he ever did, and that whole experience was deeply, deeply frustrating and sad for me. I don't know what happened to him, and I felt like I my hands were tied.
Well, Chris, you talk about how many of the young people, especially the young women, are just depressed. I mean, they're depressed. Life really has sort of lost a lot of its meaning because of their really failed sexual intimacy. Would you like to develop that idea? Because I think this is such a problem with young girls that they begin to lose self-confidence. Anyway, why don't you tell your experience and how are you going to deal with these young girls who've been convinced all along, just go ahead and enjoy yourself, and sex is, you know, sex is fun. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're ever going to see the fellow again or not. But what we do has consequences. This is what they don't understand.
Well, there is this agenda. Of course, the culture is just packed with this notion that there can be sexual encounters without any commitment and without real trust there. And people, you know, you see that everywhere. My objection and my concern is that as a mental health professional, I would like the organizations and again, the universities to deal with this straight on and give straight information, accurate health information about the emotional and physical hazards of this behavior. Yes, there's terribly high levels of depression on our campuses. We have 50% of students in one survey, a large survey, stated that they were so depressed within the past year that it was difficult for them to function. 50% of students. And in terms of considering suicide, we have 11% have seriously considered suicide. That means more than just a fleeting thought of sometimes thinking, gosh, you know, I just wish I wasn't here. That's not a serious thought of suicide. A serious thought is dwelling on it, perhaps making a plan, beginning to have some intent to carry out the plan. 11% of our students have been, you know, feel that way. These are deeply disturbing numbers, and what I am suggesting in the book, my belief, is that part of the reason, not the entire reason, I don't want people to misunderstand, there are many reasons for students to be depressed, but part of it, I believe, is the culture on campus of separating sexuality and emotions and commitment. I believe it's destructive.
I agree with you totally, and I think that what these young people need, of course, is, we start this, you know, in the kindergarten with various types of sex education. That's, I think, one of the things they want to get our kids in there, pre-kindergarten, so they can start even younger. But why would any child in kindergarten be concerned about homosexuality? And, you know, we're telling them in kindergarten it's perfectly normal, you know, and then from there on it's just year after year after year after year, always the same thing. Sex, sex, sex. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Dr. Miriam Goetzmann. We're talking about her book, Unprotected, and it really goes into the problems that she faces as a psychiatrist on a major university, and the problems really that our young people are having. And so many of them are going into college, way immature. And because, of course, there are no clear rights or wrongs ever taught today, everything's relative, so many of them enter into a lifestyle that brings nothing but unhappiness. I was fascinated, as you wrote about, how they approach the human papillomavirus, especially, if you get it, and then, would you like to discuss a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, HPV, the human papillomavirus, that is a epidemic, and so much of an epidemic that the material that's written for young women that are diagnosed with it basically says, this is something that most people who are sexually active get at some point in their life. Now, I find that distressing because it's a way of normalizing having a virus in your reproductive system, which is not at all normal. That's number one. And number two, this does no favor to our young people to make it sound like it's something that's going to happen anyway, and they might as well expect it. Again, we're lowering our standards to the lowest common denominator. I don't see my profession saying stuff like, most people get drunk every now and then and, drive while they're drinking. It happens, or most people, have some drugs now and then. I think that we are underestimating our young people. They are capable of wise decisions. They're capable of self-discipline, and that goes for their intimate lives as well.
Well, of course, the thing is that how do these young girls feel about, getting a sexually transmitted disease, and then with the thought that down the line, if they have this disease, they could give it to the man they marry. Is that ever a problem?
Well, yes, of course, because this virus, it's the same virus that causes cervical cancer. That's why women
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Goetzmann. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Miriam Goetzmann, and I was simply talking. We were talking about how frequency of human papillomavirus in college students is, and the figures I've forgotten. What is it? 47% a year have this, something like that.
It's the percent of getting a abnormal Pap smear. That is the first sign of possibly having an HPV infection. And once a young woman is told that she has an abnormal Pap smear, it means coming back possibly in 6 months or a year. It means that she's told, you may have a condition that at some point may require another procedure. We may have to remove some tissue. It's overall a disturbing event. It's something that understandably young women are very upset about. They often don't know from whom they got the virus because, if they've had more than one sexual partner, it could have been from anyone, and it can take a while to develop. There's no symptoms unless you have some warts on your genitalia. So it can turn into quite a nightmare. It's something that can cause a lot of anxiety and depression and shame. And I don't think we're doing a favor to young people by normalizing it and saying, well, look, this happens to a lot of people. So it's really not that bad. Hello?
I think that in many ways we might be better off telling people that they'd be better off putting off these intimate sexual experiences you know, certainly that's the one way to prevent getting the disease. Because, of course, you know, there's one thing that works all the time. Condoms fail a fair percentage of the time, but certainly abstinence works 100% of the time.
Well, you know, it doesn't. That's correct. But we don't even have to say wait until you're married or wait until you're engaged. We don't. You know, if we could just convince 10% of our young people to delay the onset of sexual behavior or to change their behavior and to go a year or two without sexual behavior, then we could very significantly lower the rates of all this pathology and these diseases. Not everyone is going to stop drinking or going to stop smoking, and you know, not everyone is going to have. Are we supposed to have 7 servings of fruit and vegetables these days?
Oh, I think they've upped it to 14, but that's all
right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly not having that much, and not everyone is going to follow those guidelines. But we still do urge people to know the guidelines and to do their best to follow the guidelines. So I'm pointing out that we can have higher standards with our young people, and I'm wondering why we don't, and to say nothing of the fact of websites from universities that actually promote these behaviors and say go out there and have fun.
In fact, this one website that you mentioned, what is it, Ask Alice or something?
Yes, Go Ask Alice.
Go Ask Alice. I mean, the things that are on that website, well, a lot of these we're not going to discuss on our evening program. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Do you mind taking calls if people would like to call?
I don't mind at all.
Our 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And where can people get copies of your book?
They can go to their neighborhood bookstore, or they can go to Amazon.
All right, fine. Now, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out?
Well, I'd like to get out all the information that's in the book.
All right, fine.
I don't have a website yet.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this book is just crammed full of all sorts of interesting things, and one of the points that you make is that so many of our young women are sort of being told, well, you know, you really don't necessarily want to get married and settle down. You want to get your career. And so, you know, of course, men want their career. They want to get started with their life and start making something of them. But so many women are putting off becoming mothers until they get into their mid or late 30s. And would you like to discuss really what we're doing to young women by trying to get them into careers and then foregoing motherhood until an older age?
Sure, I do have a chapter. My last chapter is about that. Another hot radioactive topic that no one wants to approach. I wrote about that after seeing students, generally graduate students, women very bright, successful, ambitious, who sadly have not given priority to their dream of starting a family, not given it priority, I would say, you know, earlier in their lives, in their 20s and 30s, because clearly they're in school, they may not find the right relationship, or it may not be the right time, and they don't have a sense always of the fact that it's in their 20s and their early 30s that it's easiest to conceive. I am calling for student health and counseling centers to include information about fertility to women, those women who are interested in motherhood, which is most women, at some point would like to be mothers, and perhaps they'd like to be mothers, you know, to a few children, not just one. So I think it's very, very important, and this is information that is not, you won't see it out there. You won't see it on Planned Parenthood, and you won't see it on the websites of other so-called women's health organizations. Information about the epidemic of infertility that we have right now, how the waiting rooms of infertility doctors and clinics are packed, and how the number one reason for infertility problems these days is maternal age. It's sad. It needs to get out there. And that's what I'm trying to do. I tell the story of a lovely young woman who's approaching her her birthday. She's going to be 39, and she's realizing that she might miss out on motherhood, and it's deeply sad for her, and that's what the chapter's about. It's something that people need to keep in mind.
Well, I think it's a very, very real problem. One of the things you write about in your book is a concern about how others will, in your profession and where you work, will feel about your speaking out so strongly on these issues, because so many of the psychiatrists and psychologists really come from the more or less permissive point of view. They are raised, of course, in a generation where we were told anything goes, or there are no restrictions at all. I just go out and have a good time. And here you're saying, look, this has consequences. And so you were really almost very reluctant to write this book, weren't you?
Oh, yes. That's why I wrote it anonymously to begin with. It's not that my colleagues are not aware of many of the things I'm talking about. It's that there is a pressure to be politically correct, and to when I am out there stating that there's an agenda that men and women are the same, an agenda of casual sex without consequences, the myth of HIV being an equal opportunity illness, that it could strike anybody regardless of the kinds of behaviors they engage in. You know, these are things that are hard to say. People are shot down for saying these things. You saw what happened to Larry Summers at Harvard when he stood up and suggested that the brains of men and women are different.
Yes.
People have lost their jobs, and I was very hesitant to come out with this, but I did it, and I now am glad that I did.
I'm glad that you did too, and you know, the point you make out in your book is so clear. Men and women are different. I mean, we react differently. We have different emotional backgrounds. We have different ways of looking at the world. We react differently to stress, and you know, the idea that men and women are identical is just so unbelievable that they would be able to sell this idea to young women, because the young women are the ones who, in the long run, of course, are going to be the ultimate losers in this so-called women's liberation movement. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, I agree that this notion that men and women are the same has brought tremendous suffering and horrible consequences. I mean, the women's movement brought wonderful developments as well. I'm not just across the board saying that women now have such incredible opportunities, and in education and all the other fields. It's obvious. It doesn't even have to be said, or maybe it does. I'm not across the board saying that the women's movement was destructive, but I am saying that portions of it have been terribly destructive, and as a woman I'm saying that, and as a mother. It's important for that to get out, and my book does explain the manner in which different myths are out there about women and men, and how the establishment, the university, and the health establishments are still promoting those false agendas, and I'm calling for something to be done about it.
Okay, well, let's go to Paul, who's calling us from Sacramento. Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Have a question for our guest?
Yeah. Yeah. What is the name of the book?
It's called Unprotected.
Oh, anyone can know more information about it?
My big pardon?
Is anyone can know more information about
it? Sure, Paul. You can go on to Amazon.com, and you can put in Unprotected under books, and when you'll get a number of different items there under Unprotected, and if you scroll down, you'll get to my book. And you'll see it says Anonymous MD as the author, because at the time that the book came out, at that time I was still anonymous.
Now we know who she is.
Right, you know who I am.
But Paul, it's a very, very good book. It's not too long, but it's got a lot of good common sense in it.
When did it come out?
It came out about 3 weeks ago. And on that site on Amazon, there's a number of readers who have reviewed it. I think now there's 5 or 6. And you can also, I mean, if you really want to, you can. There's been some book reviews. There was a book National Review Online, I think it's called. And then there was one other one. But you know, if you Google it, you'll find different people discussing it.
Well, how's Dr. Laura discussed it?
Oh yeah, Dr. Laura gave me a really wonderful endorsement. She said it's a magnificent book. That was the word that she used. So I was very happy about that.
I would agree with her totally. Paul, this is simply the things that you have been taught. How old are you, may I ask you, Paul?
16.
All right. Well, let me tell you what you're learning in school and what you're being told by your peers and what you'll be told when you get into college just isn't true. Believe me, I'm 77 going on 78, and I've been through all of these things myself. And I think when I was growing up, I mean, we did not have sexual liberation. We realized that sex outside of marriage was verboten, and very, very few people were having sex. And there's been in my opinion, a conscious effort to corrupt our society, financed by our great tax-exempt foundation, specifically the Rockefeller Foundation, and boy, have they done a good job. So I hope you get the book. I think you'll be fascinated by it. It's well worthwhile getting and reading a couple of times.
Yeah.
Well, Paul,
yeah.
I just want to tell you that the fact that you're listening to the program and that you called in is already a sign that you're probably a serious young man who's thinking before he acts and wants to be educated and find out about things. So that's a very good sign.
Yeah, I'll try to search for it on the Internet.
All right, fine. Thanks very much for calling, Paul.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, because I think that this subject is really so vitally important. We have a whole generation of our young people who are confused, and they're really having serious mental problems, and they're crying out for help, and they're going to a lot of psychiatrists who I don't think have the answers. I think Dr. Grossman does have the answer, and that is that, you know, that certainly you have to, even she doesn't want to approach it from a moral point of view. Fortunately, I'm retired. I can tell you exactly what I think. I believe there is a moral problem, but from a public health point of view, from a medical point of view, from certainly a psychological point of view. I mean, free sex is not free. You pay a terrible, terrible price for it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, well, most of the time, yes. But my question, you know, maybe you can help me understand this. Why would such a great university like Columbia University have on their health website such astonishing information about risky behaviors that most parents sending their kids to this institution, I would imagine, would be outraged? Why is that stuff on there? Who's profiting from that?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to when we get off the program, I'm going to ask my producer to get your address, and I'll send you a copy of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will explain who is behind this whole effort to corrupt the children of our country. So we'll send you a copy of the book, and I'll be interested in your thoughts on it. It's a basis based upon about 35 years of research. The book's almost a decade old, but these questions plagued me for a long time. So much of what's going on doesn't make sense, and yet there has to be an explanation. And, of course, if you get into the background of who financed Kinsey, why it was financed by the great tax-exempt foundation, specifically the Rockefeller Foundation, and, of course, our great foundation are financing our universities, and they have a different worldview. They have a different attitude towards what the world should be. And I believe there is a conscious, organized, orchestrated effort to corrupt the youth of this land, in fact, to corrupt every aspect of our society today. And I don't think it's not happening by accident. I remember when I was, of course, first went into medical practice, and somewhere in the, probably in the 60s or 70s, we were required to take a course on desensitizing to sex, and we had to sit through hours of these obscene pornographic motion pictures shown on three screens at the same time. They were playing games with our minds. And I got up, and I'll have to admit, I walked out of most of those. Most of the people sat through that, periods of vulgarity, and I don't think they were ever the same again. I think they corrupted our doctors, our nurses. I was in a Catholic hospital, even the Catholic nuns were watching it, and the world began to change about that time. Anyway, we will cover that a little bit more. I will send you a free copy of my book. We'll be back
okay.
in just a moment.
Thank you.
Right now, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
3 minutes.
You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay. Well, I would say that what I've done is I've collected a number of very striking stories of young people that came to me as a campus psychiatrist, and I was moved by what they told me, and I thought deeply about what may be behind what is going on with their depression and substance abuse and various other problems that they have, suicidal behavior. And one of my conclusions is that a part of this puzzle, the question of what is happening to our youth and why are people like myself, a campus psychiatrist, why is my schedule booked for a month in advance at one of the best universities in the country, in the world, with students who are bright and accomplished and have every opportunity available to them. Why are they needing so much support and medication and sometimes even psychiatric hospitalization? I'm not pretending to say that this is the only answer. I don't want to simplify it. There are many reasons for the problems that our kids are having right now. However, I insist that we must look at the campus culture of chaotic sexual encounters without connection, without emotional connection, without trust, without commitment, and I believe that especially our young women are suffering from this campus culture of hooking up, and that it constitutes a health crisis, and it needs to be dealt with in the same way we deal with other health crises. We need to eliminate any agendas for social reform that exist in my profession. Medicine is not a place for social agendas. So that's my case.
I think you make a very good case of it. I will, I do 5 hours of talk radio a day to three different audiences and a different audience on the weekend as well, so I will probably call you or your scheduler, and I'd love to get you onto our other programs. Our guest has been Dr. Miriam Grossman. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And just hang on there for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Oh. All right. Well, we'll call Dr. Grossman back there. Maybe our producer could call her back and get her telephone number and her address, and we'll send her a copy of our book. And I think that people see these things going on, and none of this makes sense. And it didn't make sense to me for a long time. I mean, I'd been studying what was going on in the world for 20, 25 years before I finally began to put together some of the things that were happening. And that, of course, is my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and it will introduce you to a whole different world. If you haven't read it, you need to get it, and it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Now, you can watch the DVD or the video, because the book came from the original video. I gave the talk, and somebody saw it and said, we want to put that into a book, and that's how Brotherhood of Darkness came about. Of course, it took me 6 months or so to get all the documentation for everything we said in the DVD, but we knew where it was and put it together, and it really has changed people's lives because it introduces you to another dimension that most people don't even realize exists. So you certainly want to get our book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then, of course, let me suggest you get our videos, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or the 10-hour, and it's available either DVD or video. They sold their souls for rock and roll. It will introduce you to a whole different dimension, as we've said. And then, of course, we've mentioned before Malachi Martin's wonderful book, Hostage to the Devil, and you can get along with that, my 4-tape set of my interviews with Malachi Martin. If you get the two of them together, of course, you get a special rate. If you'd like to know more about, say, the Skull and Bone Society, to which our president belongs, and when he was asked by Tim Russert when he was running for election in 2004 what Skull and Bones was about, and the president of the United States said, well, it's too secret for me to talk about. And that's exactly what his opponent, John Kerry, said. It's too secret to talk about now. There's only about 800 living Skull and Bones members in the entire nation, and yet two of them are running for presidency in the year 2004. Do you think that was just by accident? We have, of course, a 4-tape set on Skull and Bones. We have a the book, The Secrets of the Tomb, written by Alexandra Robbins. We have the book, The American Establishment, by Professor Sutton. We have The Fleshing Out of Skull and Bones by Chris Mulligan. And with all of, and we actually have the complete membership, which we got from Skull and Bones, don't ask me how, but we have the complete membership list and all the list of all the people who ever belonged to Skull and Bones, and you can get that through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Some of the most powerful men in the world belong to Skull and Bones. And then, of course, the Bohemian Grove, you should know about that. We have a great DVD put out by Alex Jones on the Bohemian Grove. We have a 4-tape set on Bohemian Grove. And, of course, we have a complete set of their, almost a complete set of other secret books that they put out that nobody's ever supposed to read. And in Volume 4, they tell you, we worship the owl. We worship the owl. If you'd like those pages, we'll be glad to send them to you. They have a 40-foot owl, a reduplication of the ancient statue of Moloch, the god of evil. And they hold in front of that every year a pagan ritual where they put on their black gowns and their black hoods, and they have a feigned human sacrifice, although you'll hear a feigned person being sacrificed screaming out in terror. These are the leaders, the presidents, the secretaries of state, the leaders of our country, and many of them, of course, spend their time running around to the woods naked and many other aberrations there. The 4-tape set will give you a great deal more information, as will, of course, the DVD. And if you'd like, of course, to get those pages from their book, talk about how they worship the owl, where is their loyalty to? Is this why things are going from bad to worse? Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927.